Good day. Welcome to episode 4 of Sounds from the Ziggurat podcast. I am Mike, your host, and this episode will continue to delve into what made those years in the Brighton area between the years of 2000 and 2010 an awesome time for local bands. Firstly, I would like to correct a mistake I made in the last episode, because I'm sure we're all aware of what happened to Bob Morton when he made a mistake. I bumped into Alex, the chap from the old BrightonRock.net forums, who curated the CD This Is Brighton Core that I was talking about on the last episode of the podcast. It appears the release party for the CD was actually at the Pressure Point, and what I remembered at the Hobgoblin was a general run-through of the album. Over the next few weeks, I'm sure we'll get other voices heard with regards to the website and CD release, and slowly we can put together a timeline of events. To end this episode, we'll have our first Legends of the Scene section. I awkwardly interview my friend Jacko about his time managing Infurion and his years spent at infamous rock and alternative club, The Engine Room, formerly located on the bottom of Preston Street. Until I figure out a bit more of a direction for the podcast and really sharpen my editing and interview skills, I've put this portion at the end so that those with no interest in our nostalgic self-indulgence have the option to call time on the episode when they please. The first track on today's episode was a recommendation from one of our valued listeners. My Tour of Duty were a three-piece indie rock band who recorded 7 demos and 2 live albums over the course of their existence, forming in October 2001 and parting ways in August 2011. This track was recorded at the Hideaway and was engineered by Turncoats Adrian Imms and Luke Ellis in 2007. It's called Decisions. That was My Tour of Duty. Check out mtod.bandcamp.com to find the band's back catalogue. White Bus formed in 2008 and released their album Where What Happened to the Heroes in 2013. Two of their members were previously in a band called Liquid Audio and were very prevalent on the scene in the early 2000s. Their mix of indie rock often entertained crowds, carrying with them uplifting sing-along choruses and an individual stage presence. They were another band that had a few lineup changes over the course of its duration too. I'm hoping to get a special guest on the show soon from the band's later days, who thinks he might have the only known stems of their long-lost album. When playing live, I'm pretty sure I stepped in for Liquid Audio a few times on guitar, occasionally at a moment's notice, and going by some photos I found the other day, it appears their bassist Dave also stepped in for Empyrean. Our bands were sometimes a little incestual, but I can guarantee always professional. After creative differences within Liquid Audio took over and the band split, Brian and Ben were joined by Chris and together forged Whitebus, taking the catchiness of Liquid Audio songs and then dialing the distortion and riffage up to 11. They were exciting to watch live and always carried an undertone of unpredictability, primarily depending on how many red wines singer-guitarist a good friend of mine, Brian, had consumed in the hours leading up to the gig. I was also lucky enough to join Whitebus as a second guitarist when they secured a show up at the Cavern Club in Liverpool. The Cavern Club obviously needs no introduction. It once hosted one of the greatest and most influential rock bands of all time. Status quo. The track I'm going to play is the crowd pleaser and one of the catchiest in their arsenal. Recorded by Russell Plowman at Soundbite Studios, you can pick up a copy of the album at whitebus.bandcamp.com. This is Softly Spoken Sounds.
Yeah.
Next, I'm going to play a track by an old friend of mine, who was guitarist of Wreck the Place Fantastic. Sean and his partner have recently relocated to Helsinki for his job, and I was thankful to be able to share a few shots with him at the Good Companions pub up the Seven Dials before they went. Whether he remembers me being there or not is another matter, and I wish him all the best on his new adventure. Interestingly, when I started to look for further information on the band via Google, and omitting any references to the Dillinger Four, two sets of images primarily came up. One being the Brighton Source magazine, which was a regular staple of venues and pubs around the city before it went exclusively online in 2014, and two, a picture of my ugly mug, from where I included the band in a bit of background ambience in the last episode. Those Google algorithms are getting scarily quicker by the day. Wreck the Place Fantastic formed in 2008 and went on hiatus in 2013. I don't believe they were to return again to their post-pop punk and melodic hardcore sounds, despite a few positive Facebook posts in 2014. However, their back catalogue is still available on good old Bandcamp at wreckthe.placefantastic.bandcamp.com. The ethos of Wreck the Place Fantastic in the early days was to play, despite the fact they were not quite as good with their instruments as they may have wished. Sean was slow to improve as he found practicing, in his own words, unspeakably dull. Singer-guitarist Ben wanted to get on with it and not wait until they became more experienced musicians, so they spent a year rehearsing at the awesome yet expensive Brighton Electric, which is now even more awesome that they have installed a bar, and went on to play their first show at the Prince Albert pub up by Brighton Station. The next 4.5 years saw them play between 60 and 70 shows along the coast, primarily in Brighton and Hove, but also venturing out to Worthing and Eastbourne. I recall supporting them at Worthing's Bar 42 during one of my heavily David Icke obsessed phases. Although I'm highly interested in some of the things he has to say, I would not go as far as to wear turquoise shell suits just yet. However, I lifted a lot of samples from the speech he had given, raising eyebrows all round. Wreck the Place Fantastic recorded their first demos in Studio 284, and their last were recorded by Cockwomble's Alley at Transmission Studios. The band ended their time together with a show at the Green Door Store, which was a highly successful and satisfying event. This is part of a quote from Sean's blog, which served as the basis for a lot of this information. I think it sums up a lot of my own feelings about playing in bands quite nicely. There are a few things that I've done that I'm as glad as I did as agreeing to be in the band that ended up being called Wreck the Place Fantastic. It was hard work and cost a lot of money. You're lucky to get a few quid or a couple of free drinks playing live music at our level. But I met some amazing people, had a lot of fun, helped make some great music and, let's be honest, playing in a band helped my self-confidence a lot. I'm a shy type deep down, and having to stand on stage and perform for a crowd of friends and strangers wasn't easy, but being forced out of your comfort zone is a good thing. I totally agree. This is Wreck the Place Fantastic with Bus Song.
Fighting to the distance, and we fight the clock with
I would like to introduce you to our first guest on the podcast. Jacko is one of my oldest friends who I met through the medium of scouting when we were very young. As he is hundreds of years older than me, he was always in more of a leadership role when I was scouting, but as time passed, our bond over Metallica, beer, and slowing down a certain scene in Starship Troopers grew strong enough to endure what was to come. One of my earliest memories was at camp. I loved to camp. We were all taking part in some sort of evening-based capture-the-flag game, and in the twilight I almost decapitated myself on a metal fence. I claimed I had been washing-lined, which sent Jacko into hysterics, and rightfully so, correcting me on the name of the wrestling move it actually was. In later years, he came on board to manage, or hinder, depending on who you talk to, my band Inferion in the early days, helping with the orchestration of gigs and the chaotic Emergenza bus trip, which almost didn't happen. Jacko also managed Preston Street's rock club The Engine Room, which I took great pleasure in taking advantage of by getting in for free and purchasing reduced price drinks. Jacko would also man the door, greeting the punters before they descended the thin, metal, health and safety nightmare of a staircase into the catacombs below the West Beach Hotel. Here are some selected parts of our chat, and for those that might be interested in an extended version of the interview, I will hopefully be getting this up on YouTube channel in the future. To find the channel, just search for Sounds from the Ziggurat. As a precursor to playing these interview segments, I would like to warn you that I have not done this before, and my nerves, plus coffee, times anxiety, are quite apparent. However, we live and we learn. In this clip, I've asked Jack what some of his early influences were growing up and what sort of music he was listening to. I've known you for years. We've been friends since we were in Scouts very, very young and stuff.
Yep.
Tell us just a little bit more about your kind of musical background, the things you were listening to growing up, and whether you're still into the same things now?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, obviously I know the answers, but our 3 to 6 listeners don't.
All 3, should we name them?
No, we don't want to get too attached, in case they don't come back.
I suppose that would be really terrible.
That would be awful, yeah.
It's always hanging on that one person to come back. Early days, it was very much Motown and Michael Jackson, because that was what my mum and dad listened to.
Mm.
A little bit of Rolling Stones and Beatles and that kind of stuff. My first real kind of getting into music was with a group of friends listening to Use Illusion 1. Mm. Guns N' Roses was the kind of first intro to the rock metal kind of genre.
Mm-hmm.
So much so that 93 I went with a friend of mine to the Milton Keynes Bowl to watch the Use Illusion tour. Guns N' Roses, supported by Soul Asylum, Blind Melon, and The Cult, or The Cure, one of the two.
Probably The Cult.
Not sure. I'll have to. Maybe you can research that one.
I'll research that one.
So that was the first. I remember it poured hard.
You just give me homework on my own show.
Yes, I have.
I can indeed confirm it was The Cult.
It poured hard that day. But whilst there, the miracle of Metallica hit me.
Yeah.
My friend said, have you heard about this this album called The Black Album? And I went, no, everything Guns N' Roses is me. I ain't listening to anything else. and so much so, he gave me a tape of the Black Album, and yeah, I put it in, and that was it. I was down the road at either Virgin or HMV the next day with my allowance, buying as much Metallica as was possible.
Which, with the prices of CDs at that time, was probably about 1.5.
Yeah. instantly became hooked on Metallica. And yeah, all the others that everyone else likes, you know, that, Sepultura, Pantera.
That changed my life as well, because it was you then that gave justice to Chris, I think.
That was it.
And then, because I used to go down to Chris's every week for Scouts.
Yeah.
And as soon as I'd get there, he'd always say, come down early. And I'd come down early. And every single time, he'd be like, I've just got to go have my dinner now. But he'd sometimes play me whatever he was listening to that week.
Uh-huh.
And so he'd sat me down, and I think he played One. I was like, I've never heard anything like this ever. This is incredible.
Does it ever end?
Yeah, does it ever end? Yeah. That was a reference to Jack's son, Ozzy, listening to the Inferion track I played last week, and his words were, does it ever end? So, then that's how I got into Metallica as well. And I'm sitting here with a Saint Anger t-shirt now, so...
And a Metallica hat.
And a Metallica hat, better for worse...
That has seen some better days. I had one of those.
Oh, this comes down now as well.
Oh, wow. It's like an extra sun visor.
Extra sun visor, yeah.
Sun visor.
cool.
There's one. There's a pirate metal that's hilariously funny.
I do remember you playing him.
But there's a couple of I'll think of that. There's more homework. Find that one.
Homework, great.
But yeah, there's a couple of bands like it, and I just it's just silly, and I listening to it. And then I've stuck with the Metallica stuff. As we know, we've been to see them many times together. But yeah, I do kind of diverge off a little bit. I've gotten into country recently.
Country,
Florida Georgia Line and the silly. Just I don't know why. I think it's got more guitar-y, so it sounds slightly more rocky than it used to.
I asked Jack what his earliest memories were about going to Brighton gigs. This question shocked him.
Funny enough, I thought this question might come up. And so,
well, it is kind of the whole point of the podcast, Jack.
touché.
Just want to start asking you cooking recipes. Might be.
Is that not what we're doing?
No, well, we could do that. That could be another one.
Rock cakes.
Rock cakes. Oh, smooth. Cut. Cut.
I recall a band called Pangea, I believe. I worked at the Dyke, the Devil's Dyke. I was a chef up there, and I'm sure one of the lads that was on the bar was a member of Pangea.
Okay.
I think that's how it was. Mm-hmm. And I remember him saying, we're playing a gig down at the Portland.
Oh, Portland, yeah.
On Portland Road. Mm-hmm. And do you want to come? And I was like, oh, yeah, when is it? And he was just, whatever day. And when I got out there, there was a band playing alongside them, I think, that had a chap called Mike Garrett.
Oh, really?
And Cy Jerram and Chris Newman. And I was like, oh... Okay, and that's, so we I didn't even know you were playing that.
Really?
Yeah, and you played alongside Pangea, and then that was effectively after, because I was speaking to, I think his name was Dave, I was speaking to him about potentially going off on a little tour with him as a sort of doing a bit of security for their band, because they were looking at going over to like Eastern Europe, Czech Republic and that.
Oh, cool. Okay.
And I was going to go with them. And then on that night that I came to the Portland and saw them play, you played as well. And that was where... we got chatting.
That's incredible.
And that was like, well.
Well, I remember we did two Portland shows. I remember like Best Left Dead definitely being there for one of them. I remember Kubrick, who they later became Turncoat, on one as well. But they're all a bit of a kind of mess. But the best thing about the Portland, that we actually made money out of those gigs.
You did.
We started off on a high and then just went downhill from there.
Yeah, that's right. When I come on board, you mean. But yeah, no, so that was my first kind of getting into the Brighton rock stuff. Mm-hmm. Was when I came along to that show, and then me and you chat, and it was literally, I think, because I used to look after Chris Newman's original band prior to 2000 when he played at the Free Buck.
Marcy, yeah.
I got them a few gigs doing that, and then obviously that split up, and he went off and started off with you guys. Mm. And I think because of that. He had a chat. And I was there, and it was like, well, you know, why don't you come along and do a bit for that for us? We're more likely to play, and you're more likely to be able to, because I don't play instruments, but you're more likely to be able to get us some gigs through the contacts you had. And that's kind of what happened. It was no real arrangement was made other than I'll do this.
And we're hanging out drinking and whatever anyway.
And we're hanging out drinking, and I get to come and watch you play for free. And that was pretty much how it all kind of
kicked off
from that. And then from that, the next 4 or 5 years out quite often every night, watching many bands, making some good friends, some good times.
I was trying to think. I think the Free Buck was my earliest kind of memories of going out and seeing bands and stuff. And I think it must have been Marcy the first few gigs that we saw out then.
I didn't do an awful lot other than going to gigs with Marcy as kind of their gig arranger and organising and getting there and doing all their loading and stuff. None of us really went out. There was no kind of after gig experience or these guys that we're going to play with in 2 weeks time are playing, let's go and watch them and get to know them a bit. There was none of that. Like what we did, you know, if we had a gig in a week's time and we knew two bands were playing at the Pressure Point, me and you generally go there, have a watch, maybe try and make contact, get a CD or whatever, and just sort of
network
a little bit. And that's how kind of we got to know a lot of the bands around, whereas like say with Marcy, I never did any of that. It was literally get there, load in, finish playing, load out, have a few beers, watch the rest of the show, and then go home. There was no...
And it wasn't just research. It was fun. We could actually go out, see a few bands. Because us and the boys used to do it as well. Well, we all used to do it, didn't we? Yeah. And we'd pop down to the Pressure Point. It was what, Cable Club night, £3 to get in or something or other.
That's right.
Three or four bands on, and
three or four pints.
Three
per
or four
band.
100 pints. Yeah.
And then over to Gloucester.
And then over to Gloucester.
And then to the skate park.
And then to the skate park. We spent a lot of time in venues watching bands, and I asked Jack what some of his favourite venues were.
I enjoyed the Portland. Mm. You know, it was
early days of the Portland, because it was Portland Rock Bar, wasn't it?
Yeah, kind of. It's felt like it was specifically for us, not Inferion as such, but us, the bands that play there. That it felt like people went there to watch that kind of a show.
You could charge ticket money as well, so people were coming in to watch the show, which was good.
Yeah, I did like the Pressure Point. The Free, but it's a shame it went. It was pretty small. And it was kind of U-shaped, which is weird. So you'd have the gig on one side of a wall and the bar on the other, and you're either in one side or the other. There was no... Well, you know, with the Pressure Point, you did have the bar up the back there as well, which you could... One big long area. I mean, obviously, the Concord was...
You talking about the original Concord or the Concord 2?
The Concord 2, I don't think I ever went in them.
I don't think I did either, yeah.
But the Concord 2... You know, we played some gigs there. As your last podcast said, we were told we were shit, which was hilariously funny. It did make me chuckle, I think, for about 6 minutes, actually. I was sitting there just giggling to myself. Oh, dear.
When starting out, especially playing London venues, we were not really experienced enough in the world of contracts, being paid fairly, or the horrendous exploitation of musicians. Jack worked out quite early on that one couldn't successfully bargain with a promoter after the gig had finished, especially while one was totally off his nut on cider.
Most of them all blur together because I enjoyed them all. I wouldn't have come along to you guys and helped you guys out and done all the stuff that we did together if I didn't enjoy myself.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the ones that I remember quite clearly for a good and a bad reason was the Ruskin Arms up in London. I think our first foray.
First London, gig, yeah,
yeah. I can't remember who the promoter was, but I mean, that's a different story.
But I remember, wasn't he? That was
pretty much,
I remember.
Yeah, pretty much. He just the amount of people we took up in a coach, and he wouldn't even cover.
No, to support a Metallica tribute band.
Yeah, I think they cost him a lot, and they weren't all that good. But I remember standing in the crowd. You guys, because Metallica had played as themselves prior, their own band.
And then we
came on, and you started with Mobiles as normal. And I remember these three blokes standing there, and they're like, "Oh, what's this shit? This is crap. Oh, fuck."
More great reviews.
And I just said to them, "Guys, you know, honestly," and I said to them, "If by the end of this song you still think it's shit, I'll buy each of you a pint." No, you weren't my money, it was the band's money, because, you know, we didn't get paid that much.
We have money.
No,
there's some problems here we've got to talk about, Jack.
And so I said to him, "Look," I said, "I've known these guys ages. That this song is a real slow builder, but when it goes, and it's you know, and listen to podcast 3 towards the end, you'll hear the song and you'll know what I'm talking about." If you've got the patience, they did. They stood there and they gave you the chance. And by the end of the song, all three of them were proper giving it large headbang. And I can't remember what you then went into, but they all looked round and they went, "Yay, thumbs up." And that was it. And then, if I remember correctly, we actually got someone reviewed that gig.
That rings a bell.
And they were really, really onto it. They loved it.
Yeah.
And they were like, "This band are this," and I've seen them at the Ruskin Arms, and they gave us a really glowing...
That's a good point, yeah, I thought that, yeah.
I don't know if you can find it anymore. It'd be pretty interesting to have a look at. But they gave a really good, really positive review of that show in particular. And then you played your half hour, 45 minutes.
We hung around for, well, obviously we hung around for Metallica.
We watched the whole thing, and then we piled the 50-odd people back on the bus and
drove back again.
And came home again.
Yeah.
So
that was cool. So there's nothing, no other gigs that you can think of that weren't particularly bad or weren't so fun to be around or anything? Or from your point of view, maybe it was all just...
No, that was probably the most stressful gig for me. I mean, there were other stressful gigs in terms of organising. I think you'll want to come on to...
It's going to come up at some point.
London's Emergenza show at some point, but we'll come back to that.
Yeah.
But that London show, because the chat I had with the promoter was very much, he was very much in terms of, I just want to pay you a flat rate. And I said, well, that's fine, but, you know, we're bringing an awful lot of people up from Brighton. You know, it would be nice to have some sort of money to show for it, or something, you know, just something, you know, something decent, the 30 quid that you're going to give us, because that doesn't even cover our band's petrol to get up with their equipment, let alone, you know,
drinking habits.
The drinking and cigars and the women and all that sort of stuff. But yeah, I think in the end, I mean, there's a bit of an argument, and it was one of the shows as well that I decided that maybe I needed to stop drinking stop drinking whilst at shows, so that I could keep more of a level head when it came to money. So I actually that did change my kind of way of looking at gigs, because I'd be with you guys just drinking, and then at that point I couldn't argue in a kind of sensible way.
Yeah, I found that as well, yeah.
It got to a point where I'd be, you know, oh no, I want X amount of money, where really, if I hadn't have been drinking, I could have said, well, it's cost me that to get here, it's cost them to get there, and realistically, all we want is you to cover that. We don't expect mega bucks, we don't expect over-the-top pay. What we want is just to have our costs covered, so it's not a wasted trip for the band. All right, we've got a bit of exposure in London, and there's some people around here that might have seen us. From what I remember of the Ruskin Arms, wasn't it where Iron Maiden was spotted?
I recall it something being one of the first venues, I think, like they played. That. I don't know if it's where they were spotted, it might have been.
Something like that.
It was something to do with that, yeah.
But yeah, I mean, so that was very much, for me, a really good gig, because we got a really nice review, and I think we played the headliners off the pitch.
No, definitely, yeah.
But also it's a really sort of harsh gig, because I learnt lessons about myself in terms of, if I'm going to do this for you guys, I can't be getting smashed beforehand if I'm going to then have to deal with a dick of a promoter.
Yeah, even if you're totally in the right, it's very hard to try and make your point when you can't speak properly.
When you're like, whoa, whoa. So, like I say, lessons learned for me.
But at least that happened early on as well, and that's good.
It was fairly early on, and we did play another one, if I remember. We played another London gig.
We played the Fountain Live Music Venue.
The Fountain Live.
And we took up a massive coach for that one as well.
I enjoyed that. I actually left my cousin's wedding early, which he's never forgiven me about.
I can imagine.
You made the right choice, but I can imagine. Absolutely, I did, yeah, because
it was phenomenal.
I really enjoyed that gig, actually, and that was in pretty cool pub, if I remember correctly. It had a nice outside
pub. Outside was nice, everyone was just in good spirits. Yeah, I think Gavin was filling in for Chris, because Chris couldn't do that one.
Oh, that's right, yes, I remember that, yeah.
I don't know why, but yeah, no, it was just a nice pub, and it was a good vibe in there.
We disagreed on a couple of points regarding the timeline of Jack's tenure at the Engine Room, which he tried to figure out using the birth of his son as a milestone.
Ozzy was born in 2006, and I remember being kicked out of the hospital. No other reason than it was late. I didn't kick off or do anything stupid or go around looking at boobies. It was just late, and Nick had to stay in with Ozzy. And so I went to my mum. She went, right, we're going home. I was knackered. I went, no, going to the club. And so she drove me down to Preston Street. I said to her, I'll be about half an hour. So she was like, yeah, that's fine, I'll wait outside. And I went in, and because I'd already text someone, probably Monkey or someone else.
Yeah.
It probably was Monkey. And as he saw me come in, he made a big announcement. And I don't think I made it to the bar, because I had so many pints thrust in my face.
Brilliant. That
by the time the half an hour was up to go and see my mum again, I was so bladdered. It was unreal.
And 4 days had passed.
Yeah, my son was 14.
4 days in.
Oh, my word. Yeah, so that was... I might have even been a Deviant night. I think it must have been. It must have been a proper club night, because it was pretty packed.
Yeah, they were always quite good, those Deviant ones.
And so, yeah, it was... That was 2006, end of 2006. So I was there... 2004.
Okay. That seems earlier
than I thought. It does. It seems a lot earlier than now we've sort of sat here and talked about it. It seems like really early. So yeah,
because that's the thing. I mean, I think between about 2002, 2004 to 2005, that was our main Infurion push with all the cable club shows and all those things, and going up to London and that kind of thing. Mm.
I half jokingly asked Jack whether there was any internal conflict in Infurion and whether managing us was hard work. I can only assume it was, due to the slight spill of my own rare but obvious arrogance here and the hilarious assumptions that young Mike's iron fist could be compromised.
We had fun. It was quite interesting. You actually listened to me sometimes when I critiqued a song and I said, oh, didn't really like that. And then I'd get the death stare from Si, and then you'd verbally abuse me.
Did we then just ignore anything you said?
No, sometimes you did. You changed it. I think you'd play it the way I said, or you'd do something like, I would try that, and then you did it, and then there would be the discussion, and generally it'd get thrown out.
That's what I did to their ideas as well.
But funny enough, some of them actually did then come back in. You'd play again a few times through, and you'd be like, actually, no, let's do what you did say.
Right.
I think mostly when I'd left.
Right.
You'd then bring it back again.
Well, we couldn't have you like feeling that you had had any input or anything.
Absolutely, because then I'll get a writer's cut as well.
Yeah, exactly. A writer's cut of nothing.
Yeah.
Writer's cut of minus negative whatever.
But no, you guys are all right. You know, I mean, I know that you were all very strong-willed in terms of, like, Si didn't like to be told what drums to hit at certain points, and, you know, you didn't like being told the arrangement isn't quite right, and...
Well, because I wrote the arrangement, so there was fine.
And then Ad didn't like being told that he was just Adam. He didn't like
well, no, that. I think with Ad, I think he was pretty much just fine with most things. He just kind of bounced off him, a lot of it.
Yes, his wings are steel, and he's
he was quite good like that. I mean we really tried to bring him down a lot of the time.
We did I mean, and fit him into tumble dryers
and fit him into tumble dryers
stuff, but no, I mean, you guys were great. I mean, we post gig was always quite amusing with Si, because he'd go up and fully fly into, oh, got that wrong, oh, fuck that up, oh. But usually a King Edward cigar about each of us with a King Edward, having a smoke of a cigar and a chat, usually chilled us all out.
Yeah, that so was usually cool. Sorry. And it was quite nice. I was saying on the podcast the other day that some of these gigs, they weren't just all about us, do the gig, go again. Yeah, it was just quite a nice kind of vibe to a lot of them, not everything, yeah. Obviously, you know. And where people could, we'd stick around and watch the other bands, because it was fun to do. It was nice to check out what was going on.
Almost always, I think, if we played a show, whether we headlined or supported, I would have said 50% of the people that came with us just got stuck around.
Yeah,
around and had drinks. And I think that was always really quite appreciated by the other bands, because I remember times when we'd play and there'd be no one but our friends there.
Yeah, yeah.
And then the other band would play and all their friends would come up, but our friends would hang around. And then as soon as that band had played, all their friends would go again and the next band would come on. And it was always seemed that our friends and my families as well, you know...
There's a bit more always, kind of respect there, wouldn't there?
Yeah. ...would always be kind of hanging around and just showing a little bit of support.
From this point on, we talked about his tenure at the Engine Room. I won't be interrupting again, don't worry.
I had done... in terms of that, I chefed at the Devil's Dyke and had kind of built myself up a little bit to potentially become an assistant manager up there. It's a very busy pub. I mean, one of the busiest in the country of that genre of pub, I think.
A genre of pub?
Yeah, that kind of Brewer's
is it,
Fair.
Is it a kind of gastro-y pub?
No,
or is
it
that
Brewer's Fair,
wasn't
it? It was just hideous food.
I remember you used to go up there and go to the Charlie Chalk Ice Cream Factory pub.
Yeah, Charlie Chalk, in playing the ball pit. But having worked there and worked my way up in the kitchen to not necessarily managing it, but for certain shifts being an overall charge, and then being given sort of roles outside on the front of house, and so kind of learning a managerial way of doing things there, and I think Scouts helped a lot, because you're taught at an early age leadership responsibilities,
yeah,
and how to get the best out of people.
Definitely.
So when from what I can remember, I went to the Engine Room for either a show or like a deviant night or something, and I remember talking to Neil, and it wasn't very busy, and the guys behind the bar weren't really doing all that much, and it was filthy, and I remember just an offhand comment to him that I'd just completed my licensing course, and, you know, if ever anything come up, to give me a shout. We exchange numbers, and I think like a couple of weeks later, maybe a month later, he phoned up and he asked to meet at the what's the one down the bottom of St James's Street, no, at the bottom of North Street,
North
that we always used to go in, and it had the pit.
Oh, the Pavtav.
Pavtav. We went into the Pavtav, and we had a couple of pints there, and we had a chat. And he invited me back down the Engine Room, gave me the grand tour, and the two managers that were there were leaving, and he said, if you want it, the job's yours. So that was taken.
Did he give you the grand tour before asking, or did he ask and then give you the grand tour?
A grand tour before asking. I saw the office, the cellar, the bar,
right,
three booths, a stage and an equipment room. That was pretty much what I was shown. You know, he had a vision, which I bought into. The vision originally was to get the engine room running smoothly, start making profit, to then look at kind of Hastings or Eastbourne, and to end up with four or five engine rooms along the south coast where you could then sell yourself as a string of venues to live bands that wanted to come down and do a little tour, and you had enough to give them a night each, you know.
And we didn't really have anything like that at that time, did we? I mean, there was a couple of alternative. You get your alternative nights at the Gloucester, you'll get your alternative nights at, say, like the Pav Tab as well.
Yeah.
But there wasn't a dedicated kind of alternative rock proper venue, was there?
Not really. I mean,
this was before the Carolina Brunswick, wasn't it? That was still the Leek and Winkle. So.
Leek and Winkle, yeah. But I mean, after the years shut down, the Hungry Years, there was really nothing other than, like you say, sort of splintered one night here, one night there, you know, possibly for us, the Gloucester became the Gloucester where we would go. But yeah, I mean, I think at that point, Neil and Chris saw the opening and decided to go and have a go. And then, yeah, I got involved, pulled in a few favours from friends and family to man my bar and do a few other bits and pieces. And from there, we enjoyed quite good success. It
did really well at one point,
It got good, you know. I had the best electrician in town coming down and helping me out occasionally. And then when he wasn't available, your brother Dave came down and helped out.
Sorry, folks, that was a lie. At this point in the conversation, I asked Jack whether balancing his home life and managing the engine room became difficult.
To start with, it wasn't a problem because I had no children. Sounds like a cow.
Dad phoning. Sorry, Dad, I'll just cut you off. I'll just do a... God, I'm really professional, aren't I? Right. Stop recording. Okay, right, it doesn't matter. Hopefully that's still recording.
That's still recording.
Sorry,
to start with, when I started there, I had no... Ozzy wasn't even thought about. Well, he was thought about, but he wasn't in process of being delivered. And so, for me, the hours, other than making it a bit more difficult to have a life, because, you know, your girlfriend, wife... is working normal hours and you're kind of in bed when she's at work, and then when you're getting up, she's coming home for dinner, and then you're going, you know, I was getting down to the club for sort of 4 o'clock in the afternoon to set up for gigs, and then the gigs would roll straight into a club night. To start with, I mean, that was all right. It finished at 2 to begin with, but when the licensing laws changed and then we had a 24-hour license pretty much, so we could operate whatever we liked, and we ended up... Some club nights went to 4, some club nights went to 6.
I enjoyed that as a punter, just to say. Yeah,
as a manager of a club, it was great, you know.
It was very sociable as well, because when you were like up on the door and stuff, doing that bit, you know, being able to talk to people coming through and hanging out and stuff, that's quite a cool kind of side of it.
Yeah, you know, we had the alarm just in case anything kicked off, and me and the doorman would run downstairs, or they would run, I would pant and flop down the stairs. as too many kebabs and pizzas whilst working in them jobs do to you. But, you know, we never really had that trouble. But I do remember going through summers without seeing an actual night.
Right.
You'd get there in the sort of 4 o'clock in the afternoon and it was bright daylight, and you'd come out at 5, 6 o'clock in the morning and it was bright daylight.
Bright daylight again.
And it was like, haven't seen a night again. That was quite interesting, you know, when you're doing that for 3 months and you don't actually see the moon.
you start to turn white.
And then suddenly you do see the moon and you're like, whoo-hoo. Yeah, it was tight. Yeah, it was. I enjoyed it. At that point of my life, I was quite easy with that. That was not a problem. I wouldn't be able to do it now.
Yeah, I mean, I used to be able to get in cheaper, / free.
I don't think I ever charged you.
And to have some drink promotions.
Drink promotions? What do you want, Mike? Oh, I'll have five of them. Oh, there you go. How much do I owe you? Nothing.
So we all benefited in some ways.
We all benefited, absolutely.
did you have to deal with many outside promoters of the club? And were any of those more memorable than others, to put it a certain way?
Outside promoters, not necessarily.
Did you promote everything in-house, or did you get other people to come in?
We had... I think they became sort of friends of the club more than anything, if that's the best way of saying it. Josh, who used to put on down at the Concord. He used to, he came along to us. He had very exacting standards. You knew what you were getting with Josh.
Because he's put on Infurion a few times. So
Yeah, he did. Yeah, but when I say exactly, I mean in terms of what the venue provides.
Oh, right, sorry.
So you would get a list.
So
this band wants this amount of food and he wants that drink. This band is expecting that and they want their own booth, this band. So
that's fair enough.
You knew as a manager of, you knew as a venue manager exactly what you had to get ready for that night, and that would come a week or so before, so you were able to get it prepared. Then you have other people, Buzz Punker Bunker. He used to put on some of his punk shows down there, and again, you knew months in advance who was going to be playing on what day at what time.
They were professional as well.
Very, very good. I mean, he still does it.
Yeah, of course.
So, I mean, he knew exactly what he wanted. And usually, we got good decent crowds down there for both promoters. And then you go into, see, Little Man. I can't remember whether I put shows on with Little Man or not. I know we used to put on some things, but
he had stuff down there because I remember because I was DJing for him at the time.
DJ Deathblow.
In the house. I remember he had quite a few shows on down there,
but I can't remember what they were. But yeah, I dealt with him.
I think they were part of the Rock Brighton.
It was about
five or six rock bands that would start probably about eight and then go through till one in the morning. So they were quite long evenings. Okay.
But I do remember as well with Lee, I was friends of his through Pet, I think. I went to a party and Lee was there and we got on straight away for some reason. I don't know, I think he's a dick, but we got on straight away. He knows I love him, so it's not too much of a problem. And then who else did we have? A chap called Pino.
Oh, I think
Tony Bowden. He's a friend of mine as well. Yeah. We chat quite often. So he used to put on, and his mum used to run the door upstairs. It was lovely.
Oh, that's handy.
So yeah, I used to hang out with mum while he was downstairs putting on his shows because I couldn't stand that kind of hardcore windmilling kind of stuff. And then we did have a few other outside people. Some people would bring in bigger bands. The Rifles was one, and that was an outside promoter. He was all right. I can't remember who his name was. He was a bit bigger and knew exactly what he wanted. We held our own and got a decent deal out of it. All the bar staff got an extra bit of pay that night because we managed to get some extra cash out of him.
It's nice when there's kind of mutual kind of respect and you can just get everyone can benefit out of a night because that's what a good gig should be, really.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, the promoters knew what they were getting when they got me. We'll bend over backwards to help anybody out, try and do stuff for them. But obviously I had to have a certain level of...
Of course.
If you're going to put this gig on, I'm going to charge you this amount of money because you're hiring my venue and my staff. But if you manage to get this amount of people through the door via your bands, I will reduce that price right down to next to nothing because, number one, I want you back. If you're going to bring that many people in, I want that repeat custom. And two... I've got to make sure that my staff are getting paid because if no one comes through the doors and I don't make any money on the night, they're not getting any money because I can't afford to pay it. So it was very much you scratch my back and I scratch yours. And we also got to know all the food venues up the road as well.
I remember you always have bloody takeaway in your bloody hands when I came in. Yeah,
that's why I'm so fat now. But I mean, we got to the point where if a band wanted Chinese, it would literally be a phone call to Odes. The bloke would be like, "Hi, Jack." And you're like, "Oh, you know me." The kebabs, the Mexican, all the stuff, all the way out the way.
But the fact that you said, like, up the road, and you phoned him still.
Up the road. Oh, yeah, you have to phone them to put the order in.
Oh, okay.
You don't think I'm going to walk all the way out there just to sort of ask him for chicken chow mein. But the best one was the pizza bloke that lived opposite us, and he made the square pizzas. Do you remember the square pizzas?
Oh, vaguely.
He always used to say to us, if ever we have an order and it goes to the house and no one claims it, you can have the pizza. And so every sort of Saturday we'd have three or four pizzas circling the club.
That happens a lot. People just forget they ordered, or they
just refused to take it, and so the pizza would come back and we'd end up with full size square pizzas.
That sounds just incredible. Just being although unhealthy, but incredible.
Oh yeah, the bar staff loved it. But
can imagine.
Cool. It was always good as well, because especially about 2 o'clock at night when everyone's really, really drunk, and you sell it at £5 a slice, and people are all over that.
Yeah, I definitely would be. I remember buying
slices of pizza from a window on St James's Street, one Pride, and there were those little awful like 20p
microwavable
pizzas, and I was paying probably about quid a slice or something like that. But at the time, it was fantastic.
Yeah. Oh yeah, you definitely need something like that.
But grim in the long run.
I then got Jack to open up about his reasons for leaving the engine room.
I don't know, how much detail do you want?
Well, just start with, no, why did you why did you leave then?
Well, I left over over money in the end. I was,
you were making too much.
I was making a nice enough amount, but I felt with the way things were going, I was due some more. I was running the club myself, and I was running the door in terms of the security guys. So I was head doorman and like head honcho of the club, and so I put it to the owners that maybe I should be getting an extra bit of money, and they refused. So I decided at that point that I didn't need to be doing everything, and I said, okay, I will become just your head doorman on this amount of pay, which they agreed to. So I was still getting the same amount of money as the head doorman as I was getting
doing everything,
both the jobs. They then employed two people to take on the role that I was doing singularly.
Oh, man.
And paid them half each what I had asked for.
So why had they done that?
So they ended up, instead of paying me X amount of money, they ended up paying two times the amount of money that I was asking for.
Was this just bad business decisions, or were they just...
It was, unfortunately, neither of them were really clued up on everything. It got to a point where the profit started to go, because one would come in and do half an hour of flyering and take £600, and the other would say, well, I'm having that as well, even though he sat on his arse and did paperwork. And so you'd end up looking at that going, well, you're getting paid £600 for half an hour. I'm working the best part of 60 hours a week and not getting that. Or getting close to it, but not getting, you know. And that's where I then decided I can do with a lot less just doing a door than running a club and doing a door, which is two jobs. And now you've employed two people to do that and me to do that. So instead of paying one person a lump sum, which is decent, you're paying three people a lot of money. And that was kind of the downfall in my eyes. It just became, in my eyes, and I might be wrong, you know, you might get an email or a phone call from someone who says otherwise, but for me, their greed got in their way.
Okay.
They saw it quickly as a cash cow, a way of getting a lot of money quickly, and their dream of the five or six Southeast clubs all working together evaporated. And that was a shame, because I thought, realistically, it could have been done. We could have done it.
I think so, yeah. It was starting to get a really good presence and a really good identity.
And people, I mean, people enjoyed it. I mean, I remember the day that we redecorated, and I put out a note at Deviant saying, we're going to do this. Anyone that comes down, you know, we'll feed and we'll beer up. And we ended up with like 30 people coming down, painting and cleaning and scrubbing and sanding. And, you know, we converted the place. You know, we finally got the dirty floor out of the way. And, you know, so, yeah, there were a lot of friends of the club and a lot of good times. And I really, I mean, I look back on that time as one of the best sessions of my life, one of the best jobs I've ever had. I just wish that, you know, I wish, one, I potentially had enough money in my bank to have been able to maybe buy it for myself, build it up a little bit more, and then look at moving it somewhere else, because it wasn't in the ideal place. It wasn't under that hotel, using the same toilets as a different venue.
That
always caused more angst than needed. But ultimately, you know, I was there, I think, 2.5 years, and I really enjoyed myself. And in the end, I actually left fully, because Ozzy got to about 1 year old, and I never really got time with him, because I would get in 6 o'clock in the morning as he was getting up and going to bed, and then obviously Nick would then take him out and do stuff, so I got some sleep, and then by the time they come home, we'd literally sit down and have something to eat, and then I was going off on the bus to go back to work again. So I never really got the time that most parents would want to have with their
But at least then you kind of you made that decision. You figured out what was best moving forward, and then yeah, you.
Oh well, yeah. I mean, I regretted it quite quickly because the money from doing what I was doing and making a fairly decent amount of money to a normal day job and actually having to work for your money was I couldn't muck about and have fun anymore. It was.
I'm sure Ozzy would appreciate it in the long run.
Probably, maybe. But I can't now buy him all the games on the Xbox, and you know he wanted an iPhone 10. I can't afford it. If I was still at the club, I'd probably be able to buy him.
No, he should have he should have a Nokia 5110 or
with Snake.
Yeah, that's how you level up through your phones. You have to have Snake first.
Yeah, not straight into an iPhone 6 anyway. that was my decision to leave was based around the owners not going through with their dream.
The vision had lost, had gone.
Yeah, and it just became an onward struggle.
As we were coming to the end of our conversation, we started talking about Jack's running of the engine room and the staff that helped to make it what it was.
I went in there as a rookie and basically just bumbled my way through enough, but with my kind of nice personality and the way that I am, in like my fun-loving and you know, having a good old giggle.
I'm sorry, who? What?
Oh, you don't know that one, do you? No, that's my Vigo. You know Vigo. You've met him a few times. So with that kind of way that I am, it made the place, you know, and also having the staff, you know, I had Monkey.
Oh, yeah, Monkey.
Monkey on the bar, you know, and the two of us bounced off each other quite often. And I had a lass called Emma that worked with us. And, you know, she was always the face of the place because she, you know, she's a very pretty lady that worked extremely hard. You know, I had my sister work down there for a while, and my cousin worked down there for a while, and I had my sister's best mate work down there for a while, and I had a lad called Jake. You remember Jake? He came to a gig at the club. I think he came all the way down from Burnley for a gig. And on the night, he was so smashed in his whatever he was wearing, and he asked if he had a job, and I said, "Well, I have, and I'm interviewing tomorrow." So he came back the next day. He'd slept on the beach, I think.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Came in the next day, still in the clothes, still smashed. And I remember it clearly because there's a bloke that come down for the job, and he was in a suit. And then there was Jake, his bright ginger hair, his dishevelled T-shirt and trousers. And he came in the office, and I said, "Sit down, boys." And he went, "Do you have a bucket?"
Oh, God.
I went, "Okay," handed him a bucket, and he went, "Just in case." And, by the end of it, the bloke in the suit, there was no way he was getting a job, because you don't turn up to a rock club and ask for a job and have a suit on. And he had no idea. But Jake, just something about him just made me go, you're just right for this place, because, you know, although I expected staff to have a certain level of something about them.
Yeah,
Jake
had
it in bundles. Yeah, you know, like with Monkey. You know, you knew what you were getting. I'd never met this kid in my life, and there he was sitting in my office, like dribbling puke into the bucket whilst having an interview. He ended up living with me as well for a little while.
Oh, yeah,
I had Jake. He turned up at my house, and he lived in one of the. Yeah, while Ozzy was really small, he lived off with us. It was nice, but yeah, I am gutted I left. Actually, I'd love to have.
Well, it seemed like the right thing at the time, it was, but definitely. It's just a shame it went in that direction that you had to. I mean, because I guess if it was a different environment, you had different people you were working with, you probably could have arranged it so you could see Ozzy still and could still work.
I think towards the end, Monkey took on a bit more responsibility, and it was good. I remember we had a big argument over the Rugby World Cup at one point. It was just a silly thing, but again, you know, you know how I am. If you've got something you want to do, you ask me, and we'll deal with it. Mm. On this one day, I needed him, and he was like, "No, I'm watching the rugby, and there's nothing you can tell me about it." And it was like that became a little bit of a thing between us for about a month.
Yeah.
But then it was all sort of dealt with, and you know, we got drunk one night, and
that's the thing. You'd move on again,
and we just dealt with it, and you know, but he did take on the next step of responsibility, and you know, there were times when I could kind of say, "Well, I'm not coming in tonight. You're in charge." You know, he had his own key for the office and all that, and he knew what the job was, and he got on with it. And you know,
it's good when you've got someone like that on board.
Yeah, I mean, he was one of my scouts, so I knew him from years back when he was a kid, and I always saw him in that kind of, you know, he was for me at that age. He was quite. You look at kids and you think there's something about you, and you've got something.
He's top champion.
Probably by the time you're 18, I can see us actually sort of getting being matey.
I keep I've badgered him a couple of times about using some of the old, if he's got any old Grumpy Jack tunes, but he's quite reluctant.
Grumpy Jack and Furion on the patio at my sister's, my mum's house.
Yes, is there still video of that somewhere? Please say there's video of that.
I don't know. I think if anyone had it, it would be Mini Het when he did all the videoing for us.
He was doing a bit, wasn't he? Yeah.
I think if anything lives, that would be it.
Because I had a couple of tapes. There's a couple of things around, but I think I've taken most of it off now. And there's a couple of bits on YouTube, but I'm sure there's things scattered. I've got tons of photos and things lying around from the days and whatnot.
The days.
Which is cool. I think we can wrap up there then, if you want, Jack, unless there's anything else you want to talk about at all.
No, I don't.
I know you've got to get off to scouts.
I've got to see my little scouties.
Yeah. I'm sure we can have another chat at some point.
Oh, absolutely. Future. Yeah, quite enjoyed this. It's been good fun. You know, it brings back memories of the years of me and Jay Voice.
Yeah, well, I think that'll be the next thing. Next time we get you in, it'll be to chat a bit more about the years and stuff. Because obviously, I missed out on a load of that because of I just missed out because of my age and whatnot. Yeah. And I was I wasn't in the right frame of mind to be like, hello, I am definitely 18. Please let me into your club nights. Although, from what I've learned, I probably would have been fine.
Yeah, you could have got in there at 12.
Yeah. I can't get in there at 35, probably. But 12 would have been a problem.
12, you would have got in.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember my first time ever going to the years, and me and James Skinner were walking from the bus stop to the years going, okay, Guns N' Roses, who? And we'd go, Axl Rose, Slash, Duff, right, Metallica, James Hetfield, Lars Ulrich, and then we were just hitting each other with names because we had this absolute fear that we were going to get to the door and they were going to go, right, boys, name us the four members of Metallica. It's like you've never been to a club before, you don't know.
Yeah.
And it's like we literally got to the door and just walked up the stairs, and like both the doormen just, all right, and you're like, okay, let's just walk up the stairs naturally. And you get to the top of the stairs, and no one says anything. And then you get to the paved booth, and it's like,
you're in.
£3. Okay. You know, you're 16 years old. you're just sitting there shitting. And then the next time you go back, of course, you're like all nonchalant because they're not.
Yeah.
Just walking, and it's like, oh, guys. I never asked for ID ever.
That's probably because you had a massive beard when you were
probably
when you were 10.
I was 16, 23 stone, massive beard. I didn't want to get involved.
Cool, man. All right. Thank you for talking to the Sounds from the Ziggurat podcast.
Oh, I loved it.
We'll definitely have you back at some point and delve into a bit more of the times and the Brighton scene and the club nights and whatnot, I guess.
Yeah, let's do it.
And I'll get better at actually doing the hosting bit as well.
Yeah, just a glass of water sucks. You know?
I know.
Five bottles of quinine.
I made sure there was like milk there because I thought
you didn't even offer milk.
I offered tea and coffee.
Tea and coffee. You didn't offer milk. You offered them three things.
You could have subtracted the coffee from the offer of coffee and then be left with milk.
Did you have a pint of milk? Six pints of milk. I don't know this.
Oh, no, it was about half of one of the small things.
So that's not nowhere near enough milk for me.
Oh, okay, well, yeah. No. Good.
Was it green top or blue top?
Probably green.
Green's good. Yeah, I'd have had that. Right, if that had been offered, I'm not going to deduct. You know, I take you at your word. If you're telling me it's water, coffee and tea, that's the three options.
Okay, well, I'll remember that for next time when I never invite you back again.
That was episode 4 of Sounds from the Ziggurat podcast. If you head to facebook.com/soundsfromtheziggurat, you'll find a page I've been slowly updating with pictures of posters, set lists and CDs from various bands throughout the era. A big thank you to my old friend Dan, who let me come and raid his archives recently before we engaged in some Streets of Rage on his Mega Drive 2. Also, a big thanks to Jacko for coming down to the Ziggurat to chat with me. Next time, I will provide a better beverage selection and perhaps some biscuits. In the next episode, I hope to bring you a chat between me and my old bandmates from Infurion. We conducted an interview at the Islingworth pub recently, and it descended into a chaos of laughter and tension that I have not had the courage to go back and listen to yet. We may not even have anything usable. I can barely remember leaving the pub, Si has been sending me texts of controversial material he wants edited out, and I have pictures of Ad, half asleep on the bar of the Druids, where he and I ventured to afterwards. So, we'll see. Remember, you can find me on my Twitter, which is @_ Ziggurat. Thanks for listening.